Post-Harlan Monologics. Number 00033. Recorded on March 25, 2023. Production location, Post-Harlan, Texas.
Necessarily the opinions of Maverick 88. Sensitive content warning. Viewer discretion is advised. Trigger warning. This series deals with topics that may be disturbing. Subject matter may include domestic violence, sexual abuse, and subsequent mental health disorders. If you are sensitive to such material, consider entertainment alternatives.
Now, buckle up. You are on the runaway train of thought. Ladies and gentlemen, without any further ado, the one, the only, Maverick 88.
We can overcome our resistance to morality. We can overcome our resistance to God. It requires that we want to do it. And there's two means to getting to that God of want. One is external evidence. It's the comparison of the corruption of humanity versus the wonder of nature, right? That's a part of it. That may or may not do it for you. It doesn't do it for everybody, right? And that's why there's a second way we'll get into eventually. And if it doesn't do it for you, then what do we go in for? Diversion and creature comfort. We just keep at with that. The ignorance of God is the shutting off of morality. And it's the end of good and evil. And then it's lawlessness. You just make up your own rules. Or you agree to abide by the rules of the society around you. And as much as you can get away with it anyway, you know, if nobody's looking. Yeah, you're a lack of character, motherfucker. I've talked at length about that. Right? Character is doing the right thing when nobody's looking. Nobody's looking and just... What do you even care about having character for? Well, you're a moral motherfucker. Anyway. It turns out, like going back to that wonder of nature and that sense of awe we get, that we are like observing the majesty of God's creation. Even if we don't believe in God, that word will slip through our thoughts, right? You realize that there has to be a God at hand. And he's really fucking big, you know? In spite of what we think we believe, whether we think we're atheist or whatever, you know, something opposed to God, some antichrist, variant. at that moment, you see that right and wrong is in our nature. We have an inherent understanding in that moment when we get to the summit and look out. We know that there's a God. Lie to yourself if you want to, all right? Deny it. Well, we know that there's a God at that moment. It's in our nature. And if God is in our nature, so is the sense of right and wrong, the good and evil, right? We have a natural sense of right and wrong. And this is where conscience comes into it. We have conscience. What's conscience? I have time to pull out the dictionary here, okay? I'm going to pull out the dictionary and type in conscience. It's a typing dictionary. They kind of suck. Book ones are better every time. But this is what I got. Oh, my God. An awareness of morality in regard to one's behavior. A sense of right and wrong that urges one to act morally, okay? A source of moral or ethical judgment or pronouncement. Right. Going back to the first definition I gave, an awareness, all right, I'm going to say quote-unquote awareness. What is this awareness? Where does it come from? You had this awareness of right and wrong, right? I told you, it comes by nature, you know? It's not something that you learn in school. It can be enhanced. It can be further defined and refined. But the sense of it is always there. What is that? That's the conscience, right? But what is the conscience? What is the sense? If it's a sense of morality, like the definition says, oh, it even said right and wrong. If it's a sense of right and wrong, it is a sense of morality. And if it's a sense of morality, it is, therefore, a sense of God. No different than coming to the top of the mountain and looking out over the range. That awe. You have a sense of God. And it is natural. It is in you. And that which is in you, that awareness in you, is your conscience. Scripture, you know, Romans again, I keep bringing up Romans, chapter 1, verses 20 and 21, Romans 2, verses 14 through 15. I'm not going to go and read it. Time is a challenge right now. But you can look it up for yourself. I gave you the numbers. You know, pause this, go read it. Both of those verses in those two chapters of the same letters, Apostle Paul's letter to the Romans, right, speak to the inherent awareness that we have of right and wrong. We inherently know right from wrong. And because we have that inherent knowledge of right and wrong, and this is important, listen up. We know when we have been done wrong. We know when we've been done wrong. Somebody violates us, we know it. Because we know right and wrong inherently. Think about it. Just drink that one in. Let it soak a little bit. We inherently know right from wrong. And then, as a result of that, we know when we have been done wrong. When somebody steals from us or defrauds us, when somebody lies to us and we figure it out, when we're threatened by somebody with violence or some other kind of action, when we are violated violently, we know it. When we are abused or murdered, when our significant other cheats on us, oh my God, does that break your heart? What does that do? Why? Is it right or is it wrong that should have happened to you? When your house has been vandalized or your vehicle has been broken into, right? Extortion, when somebody has threatened you for your fucking milk money. Somebody has made false rumors about you, spread it around, gossip, defamed your name. These things are all wrong. And when it happens to any of us, we bristle, we hate it, we can't stand it, and we want to retaliate. But where do we have that sense from? Why do we suddenly have this sense of justice when we're pretending that there's no God and there's no morality? Why do we suddenly have this sense of justice when we are pretending to be nihilistic? You know? To not react? To not have a sense of injustice and a need for justice? A drive for vengeance in such situations would require us to be completely detached. That would require what's called a hardened heart. But even then, I doubt. A hardened heart is a descriptor of somebody who is so far gone in their immorality that they are not recoverable. They have gone beyond retrievement. They're outside of the reach of salvation at that point. And you become true wicked. Again, keep reading down Romans 1. That's right after. What are the verses I'm talking about? At the end of... It's somewhere in the middle of Romans 1, I guess. It describes what a truly wicked person with a hardened heart is. How they behave. What they're about. Every thought in their head. Right? It's horrible. I would think comparatively few of us really get to that point. We're always hung up somewhere in the middle. But if you have that truly hardened heart, perhaps, maybe, possibly... you might be able to blot out, to actually be nihilistic. To honestly think, nihilistically. To honestly think there's absolutely no truth. But, when you're an evil, wicked scumbag, that doesn't mean when people do something wicked to you, you don't recognize the wicked in it. You don't laugh at it. You can be hurt. Anyway, moving on from that, I think the idea has been expressed well enough, right? What we're talking about here is conscience and our denial of conscience. This is a dynamic in humanity which is very, very prevalent, right? This is, I talk about the devils and everything about the world and how it gets into you and your vulnerability to it and how they tempt you by whispering in your ear. Well, going back to the cartoon animations that have the devil on your shoulder and then has the angel on the other side. Well, here's the angel on the other side. That's your conscience. And it's not necessarily an angel. It could be. An angel bringing you the word of God. You have a guardian angel whether you like it or not. You have a guardian angel whether I like it or not. And I don't know if you see the humor in that, but I sure do. Goodness is also whispered into our ear. That's our conscience. You know what it is. We stop listening to that angel on the shoulder. We blot it out. But then when harm comes to us, we're looking for justice. When we're looking for justice, we're looking for rules. where we're looking for rules, we're looking for law. We're looking for law, we're looking for morals. And when we're looking for morals, we're looking for God. It brings to mind Led Zeppelin, right? I frequently am reminded of Led Zeppelin for all the hours of my life I poured into Led Zeppelin when I was younger. On Led Zeppelin 2, there's a song called Living, Loving, Made. And without getting into all the details of it, you know, it's an old, used-up groupie that they're basically flaming in the song. There's one line that I carry with me in my fucking wallet wherever I go, right? When your conscience hits you, knock it back with pills. Okay, that one line defines everything that I'm talking about right now. I'm talking about a resistance to morality, trying to overcome it, right? The battle that we may or may not have in that regard. But either way, morality is there. It's real. It's at your door. It belongs to you if you accept it. If you don't, you've got to avoid it. And one way to avoid it is knocking it back with pills, like Robert Plant says, right? When your conscience hits you, knock it back with pills. That is blotting out the angel on your shoulder in order for you to do what? Proceed with the wicked that you are more comfortable with at this point in your life. See me? And I would challenge you to do this. See, I live sober. I talk about this, and I will always talk about it, because it's been everything in my life. It's been the longest thing. It's the only one thing that I've ever really fucking done for a really long time. You know. Now my faith is getting to be a long time now. I don't know, 15, 16 years in the faith, right? But my sobriety is double that. That's a big chunk of my time. So when I'm talking about things and I'm bringing it from a personal level, I'm going to lean on that experience. And I hope that doesn't disturb you too much, but it's a good experience in most ways, especially when it comes to spiritual matters, the things that I'm talking about now, interpersonally and people. And it's not always great, but you know, the fellowship part of it's not always great, but the program itself and what happens to a recovering person who sticks the course is miraculous, right? Miracles and mysticism. I live in that world now. But when you're sober, everything that you experience in your life, you have to engage with. There's really no running from it. You have a rough day at work, you come home just like, you know, fuck this, you know? And then all of a sudden, like, there's bills on your table and there's something that you weren't expecting, you know? Yeah, you were short on your taxes, a letter from the IRS. You know, all this shit just compounds on you all of a sudden. And do you have to just bear down and deal with it right away? No. You take a drink, take two drinks, go have a cigar, or go watch a movie. Knuckle fuck, whatever, you know? Diversion is what I'm saying. A diversion. You'll always run to something else when you are faced with something uncomfortable. But when you're a sober person, there's nowhere to really run. I mean, you could try diversions, but the diversions of a sober person, you can't really engage with if there's something bothering you. You can't focus on it because you've got that bother. Your conscience is constantly going at you. You got this, you got this, you got this, you know? And sooner or later, you're just going to have to measure up to it. You're just going to have to respond to it in kind and do what you're supposed to do, do the next right thing. But you can delay, or as they say on Star Trek, belay that command almost indefinitely, as long as you can divert yourself, like knocking your conscience back with pills, having that drink. Why do you think I'm an alcoholic? Doesn't that tie together? They're knocking the conscience back. I had to do that. I had to do that or face up to whatever wrong it was that I did or was thinking, you know? Or happened to me. Or all the above. Had to make things right. Had to stand up, be a man, and make things right. Or be a pussy and run away, run away, run away. And you can't run away from conscience without shutting it up. And you can't shut it up without altering your mind. Bada bing, bada boom. Early in recovery, it's very hard to do. You're not experienced. You have not accrued the knowledge and wisdom of overcoming. You haven't accrued the confidence that you can deal with shit yet. You haven't had to deal with shit in a long time. You've been running and running and running and running for years and years and years. And now all of a sudden, your problems have mounted up. You have to start dealing with them, right? You get a little pass from society. It's like, oh, thank God that asshole stopped drinking. And everybody's just happy you've gone that far with it. But eventually, everybody gets used to the idea that you're not drinking anymore. And now it's time to start paying up. And we can't run. So during that period in time, you know, I had a sponsor that used to tell newcomers, including myself, activity high, expectations low. That means just keep busy, keep busy, keep busy, keep busy, keep busy, keep busy. Part of that's diversion. Part of that is attacking whatever problems your conscience is pressing you to deal with. And then the expectations low part of it is don't expect any fucking rewards for being normal. You know, alcoholics, we all need a pat on the back for everything we do because we're so used to being such a negative in society, right? Moving on from that. See, but, you know, we go for the, in for the diversion and the creature comfort. And this here is what I refer to or regard as the tentacles of unholiness. The world gets us in its grasp by the things it tempts us into doing that breaks our constitution, makes us vulnerable for more of the evil stuff. And the more evil stuff we take on, the more deeply embedded we are in evil. We are slaves to sin. That's what that means. It owns us. And we don't even know we're being owned. It doesn't take long before we have no idea this is even happening to us. When you're a preacher, an evangelist of any kind, this is the difficulty in getting through to people. The fact that they are so deeply buried in the sin of this world. The light of day does not shine through to them. They are wrapped up with the tentacles of unholiness and drawn down deep into the mire. I'm telling you, man, any ray of light that you get that works toward possibly convincing you externally from the outside in by reason, right, of evidence, take a grab of. Hold on to it. Follow it through. Don't give up on it. But that's only one way. Now, the other way is an inside job. What happens is if you don't get the outside job part of it, if you don't get the external version of overcoming your resistance to morality, that's going to leave you only with the internal version of overcoming. And let me tell you, brother, that sucks. And we'll get into that in a minute. where did we leave off? This whole outlandish, insane, preposterous idea of overcoming our own personal moral resistance. What do I mean by that? Resistance to morality. What do I mean by that? Resistance to God, the creator of all things. Not funny. Not funny. I posited the idea that there's really basically two ways to go about coming to desire this particular change of perspective. One is by external means, meaning visual evidence around you. And the other is by internal means, which I have yet to describe, and that's what we're going to get into here, right? The internal means, another way of describing that, and I'm just going to reiterate before I get into it. If you fail, for some reason, to put the visible evidence of humanity versus creation, the visible, well, the intangible evidence of the fact of our inherent sense of right and wrong built into our nature, if we manage to turn away from that evidence, to turn a blind eye and walk away from the light and back into our fucking dark corners, the only other means of us coming to knowledge of the truth for all people, that's what God wants, is by this internal mean. What's this internal mean? It's reasoning. You're coming to reason by evidence of not the corrupt world, like I described earlier. That's the external. The internal is the corrupt self. Yes. And that sucks. When we see overwhelming evidence of our own personal corruption, I do not have words to describe the state of mind that we have come to. I kind of want to say I wouldn't wish it on anybody, but I wish it on everybody. Why? That is the powerful force which drives us into an unyielding perseverance in the pursuit of righteousness and truth. If our information and or our processing of information is such that we cannot take by external means any faith in the validity of an all-knowing, all-seeing, all-present God, then the only other means we have to prayer is to be driven to our fucking knees. Now, what do I mean by that? Again, my own personal failings involve alcoholism and drug addiction. That particular set of circumstances drove me to my knees. And it was from that spot on my knees that I began to pray. A non-religious man, an anti-Christ, at the bottom of the fucking well of my consciousness, had nowhere else to turn. how many other smug, arrogant, self-willed, pleasure-seeking, motherfucker, scumbags on this earth, besides me, have come to that harrowing place where everything evolved around and depended upon self. And self was suddenly no longer capable . This can happen in so many ways. My example, my personal example, my very personal example is alcoholism and addiction. And that what AA calls jumping off point, where you can no longer live with the drink or without it. You're in that fucking weird conundrum. You gotta shit or get off the pot. You gotta make your move forward or go to hell. Tough place. But this is not the only means. Cancer will do us in. I gave you an example of a guy who's got cancer. I could see it in his face. I could see it in the guy's face. That he is in a spiritual conundrum as a result of his mortality. All of a sudden, shit got really fucking real for this dude. It's evident in his face. I didn't get all preachy with him like I get with y'all here listening to this, right? I got right to praying is what I did. I got right to praying. I'm going to confess something to all you all. When I pray for you, about you, I am wishing you peace for a moment that you don't have. And I'm hoping that that peace is recognized soundly as coming from Jesus Christ. And I hope that maybe he might even attach my name to it. Let you know that it's me somehow. Showing my love. What is love? God is love. How do you love another? How do you love your enemy especially, right? Take it from there, that point. How do you love your own enemy? You pray for your enemy. What do you pray for? That he gets ice cream and Christmas presents? No. That he gets knowledge of the truth. What truth? The truth that'll set him free. What is that? God on God's terms. What is that? Jesus Christ. Cancer will do it to you, as will alcoholism / addiction. That'll do it to you. If you're a skier and you get your leg amputated, that'll do it to you. If you're 57, 58 years old, late into your working career, and your company, your corporation goes defunct and you lose your job, you will lose your identity. You will never regain that pay that they were paying you for the 30 years you worked there. I've seen that too. Not in my life. I mean, not to me. I've seen it in my life. I worked for the bank, big bank corporation. That got took over by the RTC, Resolution Trust Corporation, late 80s, early 90s. And they had to phase out the company. Scumbag fucking loan officers and highfalutin executives and shit were cutting fucking checks to these people that weren't ever going to pay. They weren't backed up by anything. And it was part of an entire nationwide scandal. This was one of the largest banks involved. Biggest bank in New Jersey and Florida, right? As it was in those days. When I worked for that company in that situation, the director of human resources, right, pretty impotent dude, lost his job before I lost my job. We all got pink slips eventually. They were just chewing away at the assets of the company, and when they were all gone, we were all let go. But it was done in waves. He was gone before I was gone, and I saw that guy. Last time I saw that guy was in fucking street clothes. No more suit and tie. No more Mr. Fancy. He was all broken down, unshaven. Yeah, he was out of work for like 2 days. But he already looked like he was like on the way to Skid Row. Completely fucking sad. And his story was like that. He was a director, and he was getting paid a director's money plus all the years he was at the company, right? You get annual increases. If he can go get a human resources job at all, that would be fortunate. If he can get a director job, that would be double fortunate. But he will never get the pay that he used to get. And his whole life is set up for the income he was making. And now he's going to have to, what do we call it in the suburbs? In this post-Arlen sprawl, what do we call it? Downsizing, right? Downsizing. When you come to that point of downsizing, see, your whole identity gets fucking shattered. That's a wonderful place to suddenly find Jesus. So it could be mental problems. It could be physical problems. It could be employment situations, financial problems. All of this shit is just waiting in the wings, you know? And Satan in all his majesty is not going to prevent these things from happening, because odds are it's going to shoot us right down the fucking tubes, right? If we're somewhere like trying to walk the line, somewhere trying to like sit on a fence between good and evil, between God and not God, between Christ and Antichrist, you know, not really coming to a decision, you know, sitting on that fence, hey, Satan owns a fence already, right? You're all in with God or you're not in at all. But Satan will push you. He'll push you in. He'll push you off the fence to his side. And then he'll wrap you up in those tentacles. And then he'll draw you deeper and deeper and deeper into the fucking massive acreage of hell fire on his side of the fence. And he does that with these traumatic situations. But it's really touch and go. Some people are going to turn to God, and some people are going to turn to liquor. It's just like that. It's just like that. But anyway, there's a variety of situations that we can come to, all of which really fucking suck, that will start us to begin questioning ourselves. And when we start to question ourselves, and we're doing it sincerely, we start to find answers. And those answers are going to point invariably to the fact of our corruption. Once we recognize our corruption, right, we start to recognize our failure, our guilt, our shame, all of these things. They're built out of corruption. Then there's nothing really left to do but start to disassemble all of the components that corruption is made out of. What do I mean by that? All of us have a way of life that is built up on habits, routines that we go through. And within that hamster wheel of our routine, there are things that we do routinely that are corrupt. I keep going back to the example of pulling the pud, pornography and jerking off, right? Knuckle fuckery. That's a great example. I said it before. People who have that in their life generally have that in their life on a daily basis. So somewhere in the routine of your life is a little slot of time put aside for pulling the peter. For spanking the monkey. That is a corrupt act. And yours is a corrupt mind. and it is getting more corrupt every time you do it. So every day, that clock spins around, and you jerk off, and you look at porn, your mind is getting more and more poisoned. You are going deeper away, or deeper into and further away from God. Deeper into the, further away from God and deeper into the wicked, into the evil, into the immoral, into the bad, into the wrong, all of that stuff. So to disassemble components of the corruption is to interrupt the hamster wheel of your life and start to take things out of it that you know you would be better off without. Deep down, you can argue with yourself over it. It may be that you can't imagine life without porn and Vaseline. It might not look like it's better for you. You might think if you don't do that, something's going to go terribly wrong in your existence. It's normal to think that. When you're in that predicament. Overall, in the grand scheme of things, that kind of thinking is totally abnormal. Totally against your well-being. You are acting outside of human instinct when you are looking to justify the harm that you do yourself. And when it comes to pornography, it extends out to others too. Who? Well, if you're married, your wife. If you have a girlfriend, your girlfriend. That impacts your relationships. It really, truly does. But of course, if you're spending money on pornography, you are, of course, propagating the industry that generates that shit. You're making that kind of stuff available to young women. You're making sure that that industry remains an industry. You're taking part in the entire massive production of that stuff by being a private at-home consumer. And that's just an example, okay? It's an easy example to go to. It's something that people do on a routine basis that is corrupt. I'm just trying to extrapolate the vastness, details about the vastness of that corruption, how widespread it is, how it works along that net, that network dropped upon us that we call civilization, which is the evil, wicked sin. It is the sin upon us, that blanket of sin under the rule of Satan. It is the kingdom of Satan that we live in. That's what the world is. And this is part of your part in it. Propagating a pornographic, the pornography industry. That's a big part of who you are. I think that when we're in that, we don't really think of it that way. We don't care to think of it that way. We find some way to make us innocent, or at least comparatively innocent. Well, okay, I'm spanking the monkey, but I'm not doing fill in the blank, right? Doesn't matter. This is about the recognition of our failure, guilt, and shame, and now the steps forward to getting out of that. We have to start to disassemble the components of the corruption. We have to identify, honestly identify what those components are. What is making our lives fucked up, and closing the door on that, right? You get an emphysema, you got to stop smoking. Cirrhosis of the liver. You got to stop drinking. Alcoholism, obviously, you got to stop drinking. To look to our well-being is physical-sophical. It's about both the body and the spirit. And the mind kind of just falls into place with these things. But for me, it's like, it's not like it was. It's a matter of personal powerlessness. Everything I'm describing here is coming to the very harsh reality that we are powerless. No matter what we had been thinking until that company folded up and we lost our job, you know, whatever ego we carried ourselves in, whatever that was based on, right? What legitimized what we think about ourselves? Well, I'm making six figures and I got this job and I'm boss of 30 people. I drive this car. I have this house. Look at my lovely wife. My kids are off in college, Ivy League, right? And then all of a sudden we got nothing. It gets all pulled out from under us. And the harsh reality is, whatever our situation is, in a snap of a finger, it can all come to a fucking end. And there's a lot of different ways that that happens. The devil that you subscribe to actually will make that shit happen. Personal powerlessness, right? We come to that moment eventually. We, in our infinite intellectuality, find a way to sidestep all of the external evidence that points to the reality of God and the existence of His truth, all truth. And in our arrogance, our only actual fortune left in life is this moment to fall upon us. Because without this moment, we will enter into the hardened heart. We will not come to knowledge of the truth, and then we will be condemned. I said it before. This is the proving grounds for God to call His own to home. That's what creation is. You decide that you're not going to be His, you're not going to live in His eternity. You will be outside of that. This is not me making a threat. I'm not giving you hellfire and brimstone. This is what it is. Personal powerlessness, you know. I came to that place. I came to that place multiple times in my life. I'm like a fucking old pro at it. I've had all kinds of heartbreak and loss, right? All kinds. Different parts of my life. But you know, there's really two, possibly three. Well, no, only two. There's two times of real deep, dark despair that the bottom had completely fallen out on me, right? One of them got me sober and the other one got me to Jesus. Getting sober was part of the process of getting me to Jesus. So it had to happen twice for me because I'm a fucking knucklehead, right? But that first time that got me off of the fucking drugs and alcohol, that falling out, that low bottom, that was personal powerlessness. I couldn't get along. I couldn't keep a fucking job while I was drinking and doing drugs. And I couldn't afford my drinking and drugs without a job. Then I would have to do corrupt things like stealing to get what I had to have. You see the vicious cycle that goes with it? And then when I'm dependent on those means, and then I find myself incapable of even doing that. There's a whole lot to it. The whole bottom. You know, getting overweight, drinking and no longer getting drunk, right? Well, this is what really fucking tore me up. I couldn't run and hide with that by those means anymore, right? It didn't work. There was no escape. That conscience was coming for me. Maybe that's the greatest blessing of my life. Probably is. Probably is. You know, it spoke loudly in me for whatever reason. May you be so blessed. It's painful. But I had just this overwhelming sense of personal powerlessness. I was no longer able to do just what I was supposed to do as an ordinary young man. I couldn't get up and do a job. I couldn't provide for myself. I couldn't even defend myself. Couldn't stand up for myself. I couldn't win a fucking argument anymore. And there was nobody coming to the rescue. I burnt all the bridges along the way, you know? I wore everybody out. Everybody who loved me, I wore them the fuck out. There was nowhere else to turn. There was nobody left to take advantage of, right? That's part of thievery. I might not have been, like, breaking your windows and going into your house. I might not have been doing the old smash and grab or whatever. But an alcoholic and a drug addict, they have a way of leeching off of people, taking advantage of the love that people have to offer, the hope that people have to give to you. It's real scumbaggery, right? And I had to come to the realization that what I was doing was real scumbaggery. How am I going to undo this? From less than zero, where am I going to go? How am I going to do this? I don't know. So I had this sense of personal powerlessness. It was so bad. Like, I talk so much about being a burnout. I start this whole thing off. Once a burnout, always a burnout. I explain that there's some odd, peculiar sense of pride about that. But in that moment, at that time, when I was at this rock bottom with my alcoholism and drug addiction, guess where I didn't even fit in? I had a whole lifetime of not fitting in. The only fucking people I fit in with were the burnouts, and now I don't even fit in with them. Why? Because the center, the core of that lifestyle is around drugs and alcohol. And I can't do that no more. What a fucking low place to go. And it's the exact kind of place that we end up. For most of us, if we're lucky. If we're fucking lucky. That will springboard us into the light. You know, first and foremost for me, the first thing I had to do was, like I said, begin that process disassembling the components of my corruption. I had to put the alcohol down, put the plug in the jug, stop drinking and the drugs with it, right? Had to stop all that shit. I don't know how I'm going to do it. I don't know if I can stay that way, but let's just start right now. And I went to AA, and AA did everything that they could to teach me with books of literature and people speaking, people answering the phone, people committing themselves to helping, you know? And for me, it was a mishmash. It was piecemeal. I was an asshole. Nobody wanted to be around me. Imagine that. I had to get sober. And in that, I had to first acknowledge that it was a problem. And in the process of recognizing that as a problem, now I have the doors open to addressing it as actual sin. Because why is it a problem? Well, it does this and it does this and it does that. You know, you have problems with people, you have legal problems, you have medical problems, all these problems. And alcohol seems to be like the common bond in it all, right? Of course, that's all true. Of course, that's all true. But why the alcohol itself? Well, I like the feeling it gave me. Well, what feeling did it give me? Well, ultimately, I woke up the next morning and felt like shit, right? And a lot of times I didn't know what I did. But sometimes I had a friend who told me what I did. And I did some bad shit. I did some bad shit. And I didn't have to do bad shit. I didn't have to be drunk to do bad shit. Sometimes I did bad shit so I could get drunk. And that was my hamster wheel that I had to disassemble, right? Yours is probably more subtle, unless you're an alcoholic coming to the end, right? But that's how my life was. And so where's the sin in it? Well, eventually I'll recognize it as sin. It's going to take a while, and I'll go through that, you know? Before I really could do that, address anything as quote-unquote sin, because now you're starting to talk about God and morality and all the things that we have an aversion to. And we have this moral resistance that needs to be overcome if we are to step faithfully into the light, right? I can't acknowledge my lifestyle as sin. I can't use that word. I could say it's bad, and it's really the same thing, but it takes the religiosity out of it. Because I came to this bottom, this psychological fucking breakdown, as a result of alcohol and drugs, I had a place to go with it. And that's AA. And in that place, you deal with people, and you deal with long-standing traditions, and like I said, all kinds of literature, writings, and everything, and education, basically set up for that particular situation. That's a blessing. Not everything that brings us to our knees has a 12-step program waiting for it. I did. So that 12-step program becomes a process. First thing I had to do was get sober. Second thing I had to do was unlearn everything I fucking knew and relearn it again. I needed to gain a whole new set of eyes and get rid of the old set of lies. The AA had the 12 steps. That's the program of recovery in Alcoholics Anonymous. And, you know, here's where the moral stuff comes into it. And you get to step four, right? It says, it speaks about taking a moral inventory. I don't believe to this day that I've ever taken a quote-unquote moral inventory. After dabbling with all the psychobabble bullshit that comes out of all the psychological treatment center approaches, you know, because I just didn't know how to do a fourth step when it was time for me to do it when I was early in recovery. Well, how do you do it? You know, you read the AA big book, and you read the 12 and 12, and everything you need to know is in both of those. You know, the 12 and 12 really focuses on the morality of things. I do believe it even mentions the Ten Commandments specifically as an example. It's the right example, by the way, but it is an example in their chapter of the book. But all the information available, and even an example, a start of a moral inventory, it's not really a moral inventory, it's a resentment list, you know. But just something to go by was right there in the big book. But gutless as I was, disingenuous perhaps, I really thought that, yeah, I'm going to do a fourth step. I want to do a fourth step. But I kept on doing all these things to sidestep the fourth step anyway. And part of that was doing all this shit, you know, like these kind of four-step guides that kind of walked you through the process, right? I end up with this fucking like 70-page list of shit that I got to read off to a sponsor that doesn't really say anything about anything, right? Ultimately. Because it's not really getting to the heart of the matter. It never did. That's that whole process of like pursuing your inner child and all that. You know, all right, you know, whatever. But that's not what AA is trying to do. AA gives you moral inventory. The idea is to check what you've done in regards with your Ten Commandments, right? That's a spiritual, that's the actual moral inventory. The example that they give in the 12, the big book, right? The big book, Alcoholics Anonymous, that big blue book, is like I called it, a resentment list. It's about resentment and fear. And that will yield certain results in the right direction. It will show you the fearful little piece of shit wussy you are and I am and all we all are deep down. You don't think a whole lot of people are living a fearful fucking life? I'm still picking up surgical masks on this fucking parking lot every day over a pandemic that was over more than a year ago and wasn't much of a fucking pandemic in the first place. People are fearful. That is one outward exhibit of tremendous fear. But in our minds, we tell ourselves otherwise. Oh, we listen to the science. We tune into CNN. We understand. We're in the know. We're better than you. Why aren't you wearing a mask? You're a fucking idiot. I had some bitch come in here and tell me, put on a mask, idiot. No, I didn't. Now she's finally taken hers off, and I wish you'd keep it on, hideous bitch. But anyway, besides the point, see, I could be mean, I can be cruel, I could be vengeful, I could be spiteful. I ain't perfect. I ain't perfect. I'm on my way. I'm not running and hiding. I'm facing into the light. And when I fuck up, I just say I fucked up. I don't pretend otherwise. I don't pretend to be perfect. This is not about perfect. We want, hopefully, to be perfect, as Christ was perfect before us. That is what righteousness is. We should hunger and thirst for that. That is normal. Anyway, the moral inventory versus the four-step resentment list. You know, I had to really, until I was actually truly right with God, the third step talks about a degree of rightness with God, a degree of understanding with God. And having that, you should be able to go and do a moral inventory because with God, you should have morals. But my understanding of God was that I didn't understand them, and I went with it. So it was like, okay, I know God's integral part of this process. I don't really have any kind of religion or understanding of God. I pray to Him because my sponsor says to, but I don't really seem to get any response out of it. But I do need to do this fourth step to move on in my recovery. So the alternate is this big book, fourth step resentment list thing, which will show you, amongst other things, but it's primarily focused on dealing with your resentments. It's looking at what you hate, what pisses you off, to reveal something about you. And then behind that anger is some kind of fear actually lashing out. It's like you're a fucking raccoon in a dumpster, right? Somebody opens that lid, you're afraid, and you just lash out at it. You know, that anger is a lashing out. When I get angry now, there's a fear. What angers me the most in the course of my day inside the hamster wheel? I talk about it all the time. My commute. I get angry there. Why? Because I'm fucking deep down afraid of the idiots out there. Somebody's going to kill me with their fucking car. Because they're stupid. Because they're texting. Because they're jerking off. Because they're drinking. Because they're putting their lipstick on. They're doing everything but fucking driving. It scares me. I react in anger. So there's that relation, right? There's that dynamic between fear and anger. It's the fight or flight. Natural instinct, right? I talk about the instincts and the instincts gone awry. A natural instinct is the fight or flight when we're threatened, when we come to a place of fear. My nature is fight. And if I can avoid the fight, I'll avoid the fight. If I can go a different way and avoid traffic, I'll go a different way and avoid traffic. That's the example, right? That's the example of that shit. It's an interesting thing, and it's really a side point that I'm making here, but that kind of knowledge of myself does help towards disassembling components of my corruption. It was that process that revealed something that I'm going to come to now, you know, a personal attitude of myself where I kind of had dehumanized people in pursuit of what made me happy, in pursuit of my pleasures. People were just objects. I objectified people, specifically women. I'm going to get into this in a little bit of detail, so I'm not going to get into it now. But this is an example of something that somehow by these means of this resentment list and this correlation between fear and anger, right, I was able to provide enough information in the following fifth step, this kind of confessional step involving my sponsor, right, who had to hear all this stuff, that showed, at least to him, that this was an attitude I had towards women that is basically wrong. Objectification is dehumanization. I'm not treating people even with basic humanity. I'm insincere, inattentive, negligent, rude, dismissive, aloof, all that kind of stuff. Don't engage with people unless they got something that I want. There's that selfishness, right? So it's that kind of stuff. And there was other things that were revealed. I'll be very personal about this. This is a long time ago, and most of this shit has either completely corrected or gradually through the years been winnowed down to like fucking very little, right? Very little. There's been improvement is my point. What was the other thing? The other thing was this fear of abandonment. And I had never figured that for myself. And I don't really understand the roots of it. And when I think about this, this ties back to something I think, as I was describing my super unknown, right? There was something that happened in my life where, you know, it was evident in what I revealed in a fourth step, through a fifth step to my sponsor, evident to him that I was showing thoughts and behaviors of a person that had what is known in psychological circles as abandonment issues, which is, again, a degree of fight or flight, basically. It's being involved with a girl, you know, having a relationship, a romantic relationship, and breaking up with them before they break up with you, because you know it's coming, because you know you suck. We called it a dance. You draw somebody in close, and then you push them back further away. And when they wonder why you pushed them away, you grab them and pull them back in again. And it's like this fucking yo-yo effect, right? And a lot of people are like that, more than you would think. You may even be and not even realize it. But it turned out I was like that. It turned out I was like that, and I didn't know. And this sort of thing had to be resolved, you know? And it was. It absolutely was. I get into a relationship like that. I'm in one now, of course. I'm married. And I always go in with the ambition. I always go in with the ambition of pursuing it to its end. And only leaving somebody or abandoning that situation when it's evident that there is no longevity awaiting, right? And through the years, I got better and better and better with that stuff. I got better at dating. I got better at choosing. I wouldn't string anybody along. If I recognize that there's no possibility, I'm not going to pretend that there is. So I could take and take and take. Whatever. Everything, you know? It's the kind of scumbag I was. I got to admit it to you. You got to understand where I'm coming from. Because I am trying to show the possibility that that which was in me and has been resolved, it may be in you yet to be resolved. And I'm not afraid to open up and say these things. You know, I was that kind of scumbag. I know what it's like. And these changes happened along the way. See, we get past the fifth step, we go into the sixth and seventh, and we start to get into this area of these problems in ourselves that we have identified. We don't now go to our psychiatrist and say, hey, look, I got abandonment issues. What are you going to do? You got pills for me? You know? We give these problems to God. But before we even do that, we check and double check that we're ready to move on into a life without this corruption. That's what the sixth step is. It's kind of a pause. A little pause. You do the fifth step, you take this little pause with the sixth step. You make sure you're absolutely as ready as you can be to give up these elements of your life and these aspects of your own personality, or your character, your lack of character, as the case probably is, right? And get ready. You give them to God, who in turn does whatever God's going to do to affect that change in your life. And you could pretty much count on a whole lot of disruption after that happens. Things will change in your life to affect this outcome. Sometimes it's a very pleasant and surprising thing. Sometimes it's a harrowing fucking experience. In my case, it was harrowing experiences. Like, I needed shit to happen to me to really slap me upside the head. I was that thick. I was that arrogant, you know? My self-reliance came back when I got sober. Do not get me wrong. Once I got some wheels under me, I was the same prick I ever was, just not drinking. You know? So it was always contentious. It was always a spiritual battle. And I was fighting blind. Blind against the devil. And then the help that I needed to get from God, I was blind to God too. And I wasn't listening to nobody about it, except my sponsors say, you have to do this. You know? I go to him with a problem. He gives me a solution. It involves getting on my knees and praying. That brings God into it. If I have to do a fourth step, that, you know, the fifth step's going to bring God into it. That's part of it. Right? You confess between yourself, another, and God. These were little doses of good, true, rightful spirituality that I was given as part of the process of recovery through the Fellowship AA and their program. So there's just these little trickles of spiritual progress happening. It would work to fix my character first. It would work to ensure that I had eyes of introspection that recognized my failure in character. And the change of character, the difference between the man I was and the man I was becoming, was showing evidence of God working in my life. And the more evidence of it, the more I would call out. But it took me forever because I would not go the route of Christianity about it. I just had my own little religion going on between me and this unknown God, which is what so many people do. And it was not very close and very personal. I would literally check in with them 4, 5, 6 months. Something spiritual. Have a moment. Have some kind of prayer. A little talk. A little chit-chat. Present to him what I think my marching orders ought to be for the next 6 months and go on my merry way. You know? I was like my own version of, the Easter and Christmas Christian. except I wasn't Christian. I was an Antichrist doing all this. Antichrist trying to go by God on my own terms. Somehow I stayed sober, and somehow my work in the program of recovery, the things I actually did, yielded me enough of God's attention for Him to do to create the environment for change in my character, which in turn changed my life and continually brought me closer and closer and closer to Him. I had to get over the whole Jesus hump. That was my personal issue. Problems with churches, problems with Christians. I hated all that shit. I fucking hated all that shit. That was the hump that I had to get over. And I did not have any close proximity with God, even though I had a relationship with God. It was just me and Him on my terms. It was not really a relationship. He was just there, like, kind of with His arms crossed over, folded over, like, all right, what's this idiot going to do next? But He's not doing what He's supposed to do, you know? But here I am, standing here waiting. Here's my terms. Let's do it my way instead. God makes them changes, though, gradually in your life. And, you know, your resistance is your resistance. And your resistance to God is one thing, but what I'm saying here is your resistance to Jesus Christ, on the other hand, is also resistance to God. Now, when I finally got over that hump and got with Jesus, and I'll talk about that as we go, right? When I finally got through that, that's when the relationship came personal on a level that was so thickly spiritual and mystical. That you could almost quantify it. And it's still like that. It's like God is like present with me wherever I am at any moment in time. And I don't have to like stop what I'm doing and say, hey, God, and start praying like all formally. He's here always. It is that personal. He's a part of me. He's the biggest part of me. And this is what I found. I'm a decrepit, wretched, empty shell, a husk of a fucking soul. I am nothing, really, truly nothing. And you know what? Any monk in any monastery will say the same thing about themselves. And they spend their lives in prayer. They spend their lives contending and very observant of sin and corruption. And what? They continue. These are the people that end up being saints, you know. By the lives that they lead, the proximity and closeness to God, the creator of all things. They have gotten themselves so far removed from civilization. Their hamster wheel is such a different thing than the rest of us. And yet, their continual observation, their continual revelation, is their own inner failing. I meant to talk to that sort of thing later on. I may get back around to it just as a reminder. But we are always at some level of failure, no matter who we are. Always, always, always. The best that we can do in our path to righteousness, which is holiness, right? Our path to holiness, righteousness. The best we can ever do with that is to be on that path, stay on that path. And how do we stay on it? Well, when we fuck up, all we got to do is, I fucked up. Confess it, repent, and keep going. Repent means to turn back to God. Turn the direction you're heading. Turn away from it and go back the other way. I fuck up. There's just something sinful. That's a turn towards the devil. My conscience will identify that rapidly. And say, yo, you fucking up. My job is to say, conscience. You're telling me I'm fucking up. I believe you, and I'm going to stop fucking up. That's the best we can do. Our straight and narrow path to heaven is a fucking zigzag jagged thing. It really, you know, we straddle at best that narrow path. And I say this so that people listening who have this idea of Christians supposedly supposed to be perfect people. Look, just because my focus is on morality doesn't make me without sin. It's important for everybody to understand what this walk of faith is like. It's a failure after failure after failure, but we turn to success continually every time we fail. The other way is fail, 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 all the way into the depths of hell. We change the road that we're on. Led Zeppelin, Stairway to Heaven. In the long run, there's still time to change the road you're on. Well, you can change the road you're on. There may not be time. You don't know. Like I said, your entire existence as you know it to be, and everything that you base your ego on, could come to a screeching halt in the snap of a finger. Everything comes crashing down. And sometimes that'll kill you. And then there is no time. Well, you could change the road. Right now you could change the road. But if you don't make it home from work tonight, you didn't change that road. You're still on the same road. But that's something else for another time. What I'm talking about here is, in our corruption, we are low character motherfuckers. You hear me say that all the time, right? Low character motherfucker, low character motherfucker, low character. Ordinary people, in the ordinary, their ordinary walk of life. They seem to be respectable. They dress nice. They look well. Their hair is perfect. They shave today. They got nice clothes. And they're the same scumbag that don't flush a toilet. They're the same scumbag that just leaves their trash out for somebody else to have to trip over and pick up. We can dress for success, but we're still low character motherfuckers. And there's a relation between character and morality. Do you believe that? Character is based on morality. Every time you look up the script definitions of character, you're going to see things like integrity, and you look that up, both of these definitions and every syllable, synonym, they're all going to relate back somehow eventually to morality, to morals. Character is a judgment. And you can't have a judgment without a rule. Morality is the rule. Now, when I was an Antichrist motherfucker, sober and crazy in recovery, recovering alcoholic, my ambition was not yet the pursuit of truth in Jesus Christ. Obviously, I was an Antichrist motherfucker. My ambition was character building. My primary sponsor through most of my recovery was a realtor, and that means a salesman, and that means he was very highly involved with marketing. And marketing is all about presentation. He built his reputation on the idea of high principle and character. That's how he was marketing himself, and that is what his pursuit was, his personal pursuit, in terms of recovery and self-improvement, right? And that would become mine. I adopted that, right? I just want to be a better person, you know? What I hated about my low bottom, that disgusting part of my life, where I was so miserable, right? It was that it was disgusting and miserable. That was not the person that I ever intended to be. You know, I would have much preferred dying long before that ever happened. But now that I'm alive, I have to do whatever's going to take me the furthest away from that fucking shit as possible. And in my sponsor's opinion, that was a matter of character building, which means meeting life on life's terms, basically. But because character is tied to morality, you eventually have to start learning about morality to achieve character. There is a judgment involved. It all ties together, and I think I'm starting to just trail off a little bit right now. I've said what I need to say for the moment, and we'll pick it up again momentarily.
The Downcome series continues in the next release of Post Harlan Monologics.
Thank you for tuning into Post Harlan Monologics. Please understand that this project is meant to be part of a long-term archive as a series of snapshots reflecting a distant past. We are not seeking advertisers, but may at times accept private anonymous donations to help mitigate production costs. Further information involving this project and archived releases of Post Harlan Monologics can be accessed over the World Wide Web at postharlan.com and at onsert.com. Comments, critiques, and inquiries may be submitted to Maverick through email at maverick88@postharlan.com.